This has been a live recording of the Effing Shakespeare podcast by Bloomsday Literary at the 2023 AWP Conference and Book Fair. We're thankful to be the official podcast for AWP for a third year and have invited a gallery of guests that you don't want to miss out on. As always, please subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to bring you interviews of amazing writers sharing about their amazing work. Enjoy.
Welcome to AWP, day three. So excited to have you have a new guest to start off our day. Enzo Salon-Surin is here, author of When My Body Was a Clenched Fist, winner of the Massachusetts Book Award for Poetry in 2020. He has a forthcoming book called American Scapegoat out with Black Lawrence Press. Shout out to them. The recipient of a Penn New England Discovery Award, professor of creative writing, and also a librettist. We have tons to talk about today. It is so nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
No, thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
We have too. I feel like it has been a long time coming. It's
yes.
been in the making. We've been exchanging some fun emails.
Yes.
Over the course of...
Thank you.
I enjoyed digging into your work, but I think I'm just the most curious about Last Train, so I want to start
yes.
there. It's been adapted as an opera to be produced this year. And we know a little bit about that because of our friend Deborah Deep Mouton back in Houston. She's also a librettist and has enjoyed getting a foot into that, the world of opera. And so I'd like to know what if you've found a place there, found a home there too.
I have. So it's a... I thought it was a secret for a while, but now it's not a secret anymore. So
Oh, no.
I started out writing songs, and so... As a non-native English speaker, music became a way for me to learn the language. And so, you know, any ballad that there was written out there, I know the lyrics too. But I also was listening to a lot of hip-hop as well. So a lot of rap music and figuring out. I would tape it back in the day, you know, when there was a tape deck, actually. You
love
know,
it. Yep.
Shout out to old school. but I kept, you know, playing it over and over. And then that's how I learned, you know, the language. And so... But so the rhythm was always with me. I was always writing songs. On top of that, I wrote scripts before I even discovered poetry. So I was writing these narratives about what it was like growing up in my neighborhood. And I used, you know, plays and, you know, screenplay type of, you know, script writing. I don't know what it was then. I just knew I had characters and I had dialogue and some action, you know. But later on, I discovered that there was an actual audience for it. And so I would use the name of my classmates, you know, as characters. And then, you know, they would show up and, like, they wanted to know what their character was doing, you know. So I realized there was an audience for that. But music always stayed with me. But once I discovered poetry, I kind of, the music was always there. But I wasn't writing songs, per se, at least not to publish. But I always write songs. And so when the opportunity came, because someone discovered I had written a short, you know, short play.
They discovered your secret.
My secret. They were like... Somebody told me that you were interested in... I was just having a dreaming conversation with a friend, you know. She's a, you know, violist. And I said, you know, do you ever, you know, compose music composition? Because, you know, I write music. I write songs. She was like, no, you know. And I thought, you know, that was the end of that conversation. And then I get an email that said, someone said you write songs. And I was like, oh, shoot, now I'm on the spot, right? But it was the song cycle, Robert Schumann's song cycle. They were doing a different version of it. And I had to write about, you know, falling in love and falling out of love.
Mm.
And I was like, I'm there. That's me. You know, I mean, I wrote a lot of cheesy love songs. You know, even some of my earlier work was, you know, cheesy love poems to the point where someone coined me the Barry White of poetry at some point.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
You know, for
wow.
all of you who don't know Barry White, go look him up. But I felt
to our
like
young people,
yeah,
all of us, yeah, we know,
you know
well.
The Barry White.
I depended on Barry White
yeah.
a whole lot. Okay. But we won't go there.
We won't go.
That's your secret now. Everybody knows
yeah.
it.
You're
gonna have to talk
oh,
about it now.
Oh, this
so.
Is live. Okay.
But the music was always there. But the other part of it was growing up in Queens, New York. Like there was a lot of drama, and so for me, I always had these augmented versions of what was going on. And so I would say there was always an opera in my head because I'm always singing, there's always music playing. And so this was just like for me to let down my hair, so to speak, you know, like, oh, you really want this? and I fell in love with it again. And so so the song cycle led to Last Train, and then now it's like, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
And so I'm working on I've been working on a musical for the past
four years.
And that's been in secret, but now it's not.
Now it's not a secret. Now you got to finish it.
And so now I have to finish it, but it gave me the, you know, the strength to actually say I can do this.
Incredible. Yeah. And does that friend, you know who that friend is, and does that friend know what that dreaming conversation has beget?
We've had a brief conversation about it, but I've not sort of like said it fully just yet or what, but she knows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about When My Body Was a Clenched Fist, your collection out with Black Lawrence. In researching and doing some reading some of the reviews, I one interview characterized it as a collection that grabs you by the throat. And I agree, and I also think it's not the only thing that collection does. I'm thinking especially, I mean, there's a lot of tenderness as well in the collection when the speaker talks about his friend Frankie. And one of the other things that came up a lot when I was reading the reviews is the notion that you're a Haitian American writing about violence, your community in Queens. It's often the first thing or maybe the thing that's most commented on. And I just wanted to offer a moment for you to say, how would you characterize your work or want for it to be characterized?
That's a tough question to answer, because in trying to figure out what the world expects of my characterization of my work, right? So there's like an expected answer. But for me, I live between worlds, right? I'm transient in nature by that way. But I'm also someone who was forced to leave, you know, his home country because there was a coup, right? And so there was already violence there. And now to come to a place where that's supposed to be a refuge, and then you land right smack in the middle of, you know, crack epidemic, social violence, and even police brutality at the time, you know, mid-80s to early 90s. And so I never felt like I left. Mm. I felt like I left a country, but I never left the state of violence in a lot of ways. And which was troublesome for someone like me who is extremely sensitive and caring and compassionate, right? It's a Haitian trait as well. Mm. There's this, you know, the motto is, you know, behind mountains there's another mountain. Like in the sense of resilience, like there's always something to overcome. But in the middle of that, I always consider, you know, when we're not climbing up the mountain, there's like the valley type where we celebrate, we do all sorts of stuff, right? But even when we climb the mountain, we do it together. And so I had that level of resilience in me, but I think when writing the book, I asked myself the question, like, why do I always have to be resilient?
Mm.
Like, why does this have to be in existence, right? Mm-hmm. And especially as a young kid, like, why should children have to be subjected to that? The wonderful painting on the cover of the book is a painting by a wonderful Cuban-American painter, Carlos Rancagna, who's based in Miami. And the title of it is When I Ruled the World. And I thought, this is perfect, because you're telling a kid that he's a grown-up and he's supposed to tackle this on his own. Because that was the age where, you know, people weren't really checking for kids, and kids had to grow up in that way. And so, like, forming their own sense of reality and how do I make sense of it? And if I didn't have writing, and this is as cliche as it gets, like, writing saved my life because it gave me a place to put all of that information. Because grown-ups weren't necessarily listening, and even if they were, they didn't know what to do with all of this. And so writing became a way for me to actually go through the process of figuring out where I was, but also documenting who I was so that I didn't lose track of it. So it was a piece of fiction. Like, I had become this other person. And because I wrote it down, I saw, yes, this is not you. This is a version of you. And if you wrote it down, it means that somewhere along the way, you'll recognize that you keep reminding yourself, right, that this is not you. And I think the danger for me was, if one day I woke up and I said, this is me, I would know that the transition had happened fully, right? That I had been overcome by my environment and so forth. And so the tenderness that you talk about was how I kept a part of me alive, right?
Yeah.
And the clenched fist is a metaphor for, you know, a lot of people think it's about, you know, violence in a sense, right? But if you think about a fist, we make a fist when we want to protect something as well.
We want to keep it,
right? And so, but it's not viewed as a fist just because it's turned in a different way, right? And what I kept inside was this tenderness, even if it meant that my whole body had to become a fist to protect what was inside until it was safe. Yeah.
It is beautiful. Incredible. Thank you. You, in addition to writing librettos and stage plays and books of poetry, that's books with an S at the end of it, you are the executive director of Central Square Press, whose mission is to publish poetry that does not cater to the academic establishment, but is part of the witness continuum. And I wonder if you can tell me more about that mission.
Yeah, so it's, in a lot of ways, what I do, it seems like it's a lot of work, a lot of different things, but there's a thread, you know, throughout. And the witness continuum has to do with the responsibility of a writer. Not every writer, but those who feel compelled to write about an experience that there's a way to write about it that pays homage to not just the person who experienced it, but even the culture in which it was formed, right? But at the same time, pointing out that there are significant changes that need to happen, but don't necessarily happen, right, from generation to generation. So it is about documenting things. And I always consider all of my books and all these poems as artifacts, right? In my head, I keep thinking somewhere along the way, you know, it's the end of the world and there's debris somewhere. And then somewhere buried underneath some ash is, you know, When My Body Was a Clenched Fist or American Scapegoat, and someone shakes it off. A few of the pages are singed, but then they're reading this and they're like, wait, was this what it was like? I wonder. And when they start to piece other things together, hopefully there's a hint in there about how we even came to the cataclysmic end of the world, kind of, right?
Yeah.
But this is how we live and this is how we survive. And so when it came time to look at publishing, I was part of an MFA program, which I noticed a lot of people were writing about significant work, but they were afraid that it wasn't going to get published because, as we were talking about before, like, there's no audience. And we talked, and I was like, that's a shame. And I said, well, maybe one of us could be a publisher. They were like, yeah, that'd be nice. And, of course, I'm like, researched. You know, I found this great, you know, publishing certificate program at Emerson. It was like this one-week boot camp, you know, extremely intensive.
Nice, yeah.
I'm like, can I tap out? You know, because it was intense and I was, you know, working at the same time, full time. So I was just like, how do I do this? But I knew at the end of that, it was about other people's work. And so I needed to figure out how that was going to happen. So by the time I graduated, actually, with my own MFA in creative writing, I already had the certificate. So I was ready to not just publish my own work, but other people's work, because they are writing about significant things. And it's not about, for me, it's not about finding an audience. The audience already exists. And if a publisher has not discovered the audience, it's not up to the writer to, you know, to galvanize and to, you know. I mean, I was talking with an agent last year, right? And they were thinking about representing American Scapegoat. And the one thing that they told me was, you know, they went back and I didn't hear for a while. 6 months went by and I said, well, they wanted to do it as a junior agent, but the agency didn't want to represent the work because they came back with, my platform wasn't big enough. And by that they meant my Instagram was at 600 people. And it was that way because I had deleted about 300 people who weren't actually people, right?
Yeah.
And so at some point I said, oh, and I'm doing readings where the rooms are packed, right? And there are people in the room, but I'm also having conversations with people, which is even more important for me, right? In the real world, I'm like, there is an audience, but they're not recognizing that. So, and I thought about how, what is it like for an artist, you know, or writer who hasn't even published anything yet? It's very hard to break into it. So I said, if I can do something, however small, and we did chapbooks, we continue to do chapbooks, 13 poems, right, in the chapbooks, and that started with Alpha Michael Weaver, who, you know, A Hard Summation, his book, because he was having a hard time shopping that particular chapbook, which is kind of crazy because he's published like 15 books, right? But the subject matter was at heart, and I thought, well, we need to represent a body of work that people find very difficult to talk about, but also very hard to publish. And what I found out, there is a market, there is a readership, as long as you publish it. So it's not about building, you know, waiting for the people to show up, and then you say, I'm going to build a stadium.
Right.
Let's build the stadium because we know people will come. We just need to have room for that. So I just wanted to create room for the writers and readers alike.
Yeah. Yeah. And instead of it being about a platform of abstract numbers,
yes,
it sounds like what you're saying is relationships.
Yes,
it's much so.
Relational. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, here is the $10,000 question. Is it $64,000 question? How do you do this?
65. I don't know.
It's a lot of money. It's a question worth a lot of money. And if you can solve it today, Enzo, we're all going to be better.
Are we counting inflation as part of that, too?
Okay, yeah. Does that mean go
76,
up?
Yes.
Okay,
6%.
76. That's good. $76,000 question. How do you balance your creative pursuits? I mean, you're representing other authors, you're doing your own work, but then there has to be some kind of space for you as an artist to experience life from which to draw from your art and your work. So how do you balance it?
The short answer is I don't. The end. Okay, that's it. You know, can I get my $76,000?
You know? There you go.
The check's in the mail, man.
And when I say that, I mean that we always look for balance, right? But what does that look like? What does that, you know, what does that even mean, right? And we're thinking in percentages. So 40% here, 60% here. But we can't sustain that level of balance, right? We can't sustain that ratio all the time. And so kind of like the earth, right? Like it's always shifting. And so whether it's time zones or the tides means like the water is squeezed out on the other end of the world. So the high tide there and it's low tide here. I think it's the same with us as human beings, that we have to continue to shift. And so when I'm writing, I'm writing. And when I'm publishing, right? And so there's a reason why I publish one chapbook a year. And if on a particular year I don't have as much of my own plate, and being a single father as well, you know, having two boys, it's like, no, I need to spend more time with my boys this year. Or I need to spend time catching up with myself, or, you know, checking on my mental health, my physical health, and the likes, right? But it's about shifting. So there are time periods where I am 100% in the studio or in my own head, in which case I'm very careful about the type of things I accept. I've gotten better at it simply because I was crashing before, you know, mm-hmm. and I was struggling, I was stressed out, and I said, wait, you have a choice. It is an option.
We do?
We do, and that's the part that, you know,
yeah.
So it's about letting go. I think I've become a lot better at it because I've had to make some difficult decisions the past couple of years where I said, you know, if I don't make that shift, I probably won't be around to see the fruits of my labor, mm-hmm. right? And I said, more importantly, these boys need a father, you know, more than they need me as a poet and everything else. And so I said, once I figured that part out, it was a lot easier to figure out that, yeah, today it's 40%, but tomorrow is going to be 15% because that's only as much as I can do. And when you have the right people, you talk about personal relationships, right? When you have the right people with you, including some of my authors, you know, going through the pandemic, it's like, no, we have to push this book back because there's a lot of other stuff. Angel Dyer, her book, Breathe, was one of those. We had talked about it before the pandemic, but it didn't come out until, you know, November of 2021. Most artists or writers would have walked away, but she understood. And when it came time to publish it, wonderful design, great book, and it's out there now. And so it is about giving each other that grace, right, that time period to adjust, but more so self-grace. Telling someone no, and if you have to pass up an opportunity, you pass it up. Because at the end of the day, it's not worth struggling. It's not worth, you know, losing your mind over. So,
yeah. And trust that something else is coming down the road.
And there's always something down the road. It might be different than what you expected.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I'm here on this podcast, you know, because I had to cancel something before, right? And then all of a sudden, AWP became a possibility.
Right, right. Well, we're glad you're here.
No, thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about all of this. I could ask 16 more questions, I think. But I'm going to finish up with asking you, what is the most AWP thing that you've heard so far at AWP this year?
So I didn't think I had one until I ran into a friend last night. And I'm staring at her, like, right in the face. And she's looking at me, but she's seeing through me. Like, And I'm like waving, right? And her daughter's standing next to her giggling, right? Waiting to see how long her mom would take to recognize me. And I'm like, I'm waving. She still doesn't see me. And so I'm like, and I call out her name, right? And she was like, oh my gosh, Enzo. And I was like, yeah, for about a minute or so, I've been waving. But she was looking to her husband across the street. But I was like right there. She didn't see me. And I thought, that's AWP.
That is everything AWP right like, there. Every relationship, every situation.
And to not take it personal, right? Because people were like, oh, I can't believe this person didn't see. I was like, no, they didn't see you. You know? They're like in Deep Space Nine or something, you know?
Yeah, staring off at someone else.
You know? AWP is a portal, so you have to be careful because you might actually end up way on the other side of the universe. So
it is true. It is true. And I think the portal are those windows up there. They're all staring down at us like little gerbils. It is a pleasure. I am so happy to meet you in person.
Same here.
And to know you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Anton.
Effing Shakespeare is a production of Bloomsday Literary, hosted by Kate Martin Williams, Jessica Cole, and produced by me, Fu Lu. Our trusty and hardworking intern is Elena Welsh. With special thanks to Juanita Lester and the AWP staff, without whom this would not be possible.